Interview with G. Bradford Cook, May 8th, 2007, in Bethesda, Maryland, by Kenneth Durr.
So I want to start out with a little bit about your background. You went to undergrad at Stanford, is that right?
Right.
And you were from the, were you from the Midwest at that
point? I was born in Lincoln, Nebraska.
How'd you end up in Stanford?
Well, what I went to grade school and to junior high school in Lincoln, and then I was sent away at my, not request, but at my father's request to Phillips Exeter Academy in Exeter, New Hampshire. And I went away in ninth grade and then graduated in 1955. Well, what happened was my father insisted that I come back to Nebraska and go to University of Nebraska after I graduated from Exeter. But I'd never been on the West Coast before. Having spent 4 years on the East Coast, I thought it'd be a great opportunity to go west. So I convinced him to let me go to Stanford. And I applied to Stanford Law School and was accepted after I graduated, and decided to turn it down and go home to Lincoln and go to the University of Nebraska Law School. And the reason I did that was because I thought I might get into active politics, and it would be easier in Nebraska to be in politics than in California. So I went to the University of Nebraska Law School. And after being in, it's a three-year school, of course, and at the end of my second year, I decided I wanted to go and practice corporate law. So I went to Chicago and joined a law firm by the name of Winston Strawn.
Tell me about that firm. It's got a good reputation.
Well, it's interesting because how I got the interview there. I'd gone through Martindale and Hubbell, which is the book that lists all the attorneys. And I picked out two or three firms just on name and size. And I was on the way into Chicago on with my father and some of his friends. And one of his friends was a very prominent businessman from Chicago. And he asked me why I was on the trip. And I said, well, I was going to go in and look for interviews. And he said, what firms are you looking at? And I mentioned Winston Strawn as one of them. And he said, well, I know the senior partner there very well, and I'll call him and tell him that I know you and your background. So I got into the senior partner's office, and I was having the interview conducted, and we were talking mainly about fishing and hunting.
Who was the senior partner?
Charlie Calderini. And on my resume, I had been a seasonal park ranger in the Olympic National Park between my junior and senior year in college. And Mr. Calderini said, well, do they have Olympic elk out in the Olympic National Park? I said, well, yeah, they did. And that kind of led into a hunting discussion and a fishing discussion. And then the phone rang in his office, and it was the gentleman from Chicago who was supposed to have called him before the interview. And he said, oh, yes, Brad's here sitting in my office. So here I thought the wheels had been greased. And well, they hadn't. I just got into his office on my own initiative.
Now, did things stick on fishing and hunting even after that phone call?
Well, we didn't go over much about grades and so forth. I think I sold him on personality. And, of course, Nebraska Law School did not have a national reputation for excellent. You know, it's a good law school. It's very small in those days. And so they hired me. And he wanted me, this was during the summer, and he, when the interview was conducted, he wanted me to start the next day and be a summer student there. And I said I couldn't do that because I had another job in Lincoln for the summer.
Now, when is this?
This would be 1962.
So you came in the fall then?
I came in June after I graduated from Nebraska and took the Nebraska bar exam. Excuse me. And the policy of Winston Strawn was that they'll give you all the time you need to study for the bar during the summer, but if you flunk the bar, you're out. And I said to Mr. Calderini when he explained that policy to me, I said, well, what if you have a bad day? And he said, we don't have bad days at Winston Strawn. So I studied for the bar during the summer with a few of my contemporaries and passed the bar. And after the exam was graded and so forth, and started actively working full-time in the fall of 62.
Yeah, did you get into securities law pretty quickly?
I did. I got really more into, I'd call it more like banking law because of private placements of debt. And then I kind of morphed into securities law, public offerings, mergers and acquisitions, and that sort of law. Green goods law, as we call it.
Did you have much interface with the SEC?
Not a great deal. We have filings. I had one or two meetings in Washington with the staff during the 60s, but not a lot of interface.
This would have been the Kerry SEC at this point, I guess.
I'm trying to think when Manny Cohen came in. That was before Casey.
Yeah, Cohen probably came in 64, 65.
Yeah, I think that's about right.
I just wonder if you had a sense of the commission, whether it seemed to you to be active at this point or something that corporate and securities attorneys didn't worry unduly about.
Well, I'd say we were intimidated by the commission. I don't think I held them in awe or was afraid of the commission, but we were certainly respectful of their views. Well, what happened was I was active in politics in Chicago and Republican politics. And a very dear friend of my father's by the name of Peter Flanagan, who had been with Dylan Reed, had been in the Nixon administration. And we met one time in our summer home in Minnesota, and he said, Brad, we're trying to recruit young lawyers to come down to Washington in the Nixon administration. And he said that one position in particular that was available was general counsel of the Federal Communications Commission. And I said, Peter, I don't know anything about radios other than to turn them on and listen to them. And he said, well, this would be a great opportunity to come from Chicago and then go back to Chicago and start a Federal Communications Commission practice. And I said, I'm really not interested in that. I said, the only thing I'd be interested in would be the Securities and Exchange Commission. And in the meantime, I was invited to come down and interview for the general counsel of HEW. And that came through a relationship with Pete Mark, accounting firm. And I interviewed there, and I can't think of the gentleman's name from California who was the head of HEW, close Nixon ally. But I looked at the HEW, and it was just too big an organization. And again, it wasn't my specialty. So I kind of kept tabs on the SEC. And when Phil Loomis, who was general counsel, became a commissioner, that opened up the position in the general counsel's office. And I called Peter, and I said, Peter Flanagan, and I said, Peter, now this is something I might be interested in. So he said, well, come down, and I'll set up an interview with the personnel department. And then if it proceeds beyond that, you can meet Bill Casey. So that's how that evolved.
So you were keeping an eye on the SEC then?
As an opportunity for...
Were these other opportunities, the FCC, the HEW, were these back in 68?
About the same time frame, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because then the SEC you got into, clearly a couple years have gone by, 71.
Right.
So you came in and did the interview. Did you meet Casey
first? Casey took me to lunch, and he asked how many billable hours I'd banked per year, and I gave him the number. I can't recall what it is now. But like most, I was then a partner at Winston Strawn. And like most young lawyers, I mean, you worked long, long hours. And... He, I guess, was impressed by that. And the interview really was not something, it was not in a depth interview. I think he took a liking to me. And so he said, well, would you be interested in, you know, the general counsel's position? And I kind of said to him, well, maybe, but maybe a commissioner's position. I was pretty bold. And he said, no, you want to be general counsel because that's the second best job in the commission. And I said, how do you mean that? And he said, well, as a commissioner, other than as chairman, you don't have a large staff. Whereas general counsel, you have a large staff of lawyers. And, I'll make sure everything goes through your office. And that you're involved in not only the legal aspects, but in policy issues. So I said, okay. And he said, well, go home and think about it. And I went back to Chicago, and when I got back to Chicago, I called him and I said, I'd be happy to do it. And this was like the middle of the summer of 71. And he said, I want you to start right away. And I said, well, I can't. I had other thing, obligations. So I think my official start date was September 1st, 71.
Did Casey tell you a little bit about what he wanted to do with the SEC at this point?
Not really. Of course, that evolved very quickly when I got there. And I was not familiar with all the issues that were on the stove boiling, and I really was almost self-taught. I mean, I had to read the memos quickly. I took a lot of them with me when I had them send me a lot of the issues that were pending. I had the general counsel's office send me the briefs they were filing on certain issues.
So you did some studying before you
actually officially started, right? But was mainly self-taught and picked up. I mean, I remember vividly showing up for work and on September, early September, and Casey called me up to his office. He said, we have a congressional hearing, and I want you to be there. And I said, what's the issue on the hearing? I'd never been in a congressional hearing in my life. He said, well, the issue is going to come up on who has primary jurisdiction or exclusive jurisdiction over commission rates. And does the SEC have it, or does the Antitrust Department have it, or whatever? And, I mean, I was dumbfounded. I didn't know what he was talking about. So I went down to my staff, and I talked to one of the associate general counsel, and he said, well, a guy named Seltzer, I can't think of his first name, he's kind of been working on that. So I called him into my office and I said, explain to me the differences here. And he did quickly. So I said, well, come on, we're going over to this congressional hearing with the chairman. And we got into the hearing, and Bill Casey was hard to understand because it was like he had marbles in his mouth. He had a very strong New York accent. And I think it was Pete Williams from New Jersey was conducting the hearing in the Senate. And they asked the chairman a question on jurisdiction over commission rates. And Bill said, well, my general counsel will respond to that. And I mean, I didn't have hayseed in my ears, but.
This was the same day that you came in?
Almost the same day or second day. Yeah, pretty early. And I said, well, our position is that we have, primary jurisdiction, maybe exclusive jurisdiction. And that was all I said, and nobody questioned it. Nobody probed me any deeper than that. And so here I was, a kid from Lincoln, Nebraska, off and running, not having a chance to sit down before Congress. So,
And this was one of the big issues, if not the big
issue. It was a huge issue. Because the industry was suffering. It was losing money.
Why?
Trading was down. Stock prices were down. Commission rates were eroding. Even though they were still fixed at certain levels, there were different ways that institutional trading could take advantage and negotiate rates off the exchanges. And for the large institutions, and the market was starting to be institutionalized away from the individual investor, there were ways to negotiate rates, even though the New York Stock Exchange had a fixed rate. They do trades up in the upstairs trades. They'd go on the other regional exchanges. They were seeking exchange membership in those days in order to recapture commissions. Philadelphia Exchange welcomed them. The New York Stock Exchange refused to have institutions. And we passed a rule, actually Harvey Pitt devised, Rule 19b-2, where we said that if you are a member of a stock exchange, you have to be doing a public business. So that slowed down the drive for institutional membership. But as the fixed rates were eventually eliminated, then that institutions did not want to become members unless they were actually doing a public business.
Of the other stock exchanges?
Well, of any of the exchanges, yeah, there was the incentive to do that disappeared. Because again, the rule 19b-2 said if you want to become a member of exchange, you have to be doing a public business.
How did you define public business?
My memory's not that good.
I guess I'm not quite clear on the concept.
Well, the concept is that you have to be dealing with the public rather than just dealing for yourself.
Because institutional investor would be dealing for the public.
Well, it would not only be doing its own business, but it had to be holding itself out as being open to the public rather than
a dealer or a broker or something like that could be doing the
public. Yeah.
And this first hearing, the interesting thing there is you weren't even talking about whether to fix, unfix commission rates, not even about jurisdiction.
Well, what our position was at the SEC was that we had a minimum primary jurisdiction. In other words, we had the right to set rates. We'd always set rates. The New York Stock Exchange would come in for rate increases or over the period of going back to the 40s, I think, or 50s. And what was happening was that the SEC was becoming kind of a utility commission. It would take studies from the New York Stock Exchange to justify rate increases, and then it would approve them or roll them back or whatever. And the time process that took to go through this procedure was maybe a year, up to a year. So by the time the rates were approved, a different set of circumstances were in existence in the market. And the brokers, Skiers industry had gone through a wrenching experience in the back office problems in the late 60s, and they were just kind of coming out of that. And a lot of firms went into bankruptcy, and that's why the SIPC Act was passed. And that was like in 70 or 71. And so we had made a determination to go to negotiated rates at certain breakpoints. Started at 500, then it went down to 300, then it went down to 100, and then Congress, I think, passed a bill in the mid-70s to eliminate fixed rates entirely.
What did you see happen as you lowered that breakpoint?
Well, our position, our legal position was that we were the unique body because we were, you know, we regulated the securities markets, and that we were in a better position to judge the effect of lower rates on the brokerage industry than anyone else. The Justice Department and in private, well, was taking the sides in private litigation to, there was a case out in Milwaukee in the federal courts where, I can't recall the name of the case, but where there was a challenge to the fixed rate at any level for antitrust purposes. And the Justice Department was siding with the private litigant to say there were antitrust violations on the fixed rates. And our position was that, we either had exclusive jurisdiction, so the courts had no say in the matter, or we had primary jurisdiction, which meant we had the first crack at it. And the Justice Department fought us tooth and nail on that. So we were within the same administration. We were at loggerheads.
Why did the SEC take that position? It seems like the effect would be the same, the result.
Well, we wanted to, I coined the term that the chairman, Casey, then used called prudent gradualism. And that we told the industry that we were going to negotiate rates over a period of time. But we wanted to do it in increments and then see what happened each time we lowered it, because the industry was saying, especially the small broker dealers, the regional broker dealers, we're saying that without a fixed rate and a cushion, so to speak, they couldn't give research to their clients, and that the industry being in perilous condition to start with at that time, that going to negotiated rates would, they'd lose all the institutional business to the big, wealthier brokerage houses, and that the small brokerage house serving the individual customer would probably go out of business because they couldn't charge enough fees. Of course, I think what happened in practice was the fees increased for the smaller individual investor, and or negotiated. Oh, they always were kind of negotiated with the big investor. So the fixed rate really was a fixed rate for the smaller trades anyway, because the big guys could do it other ways, could get it back.
But they couldn't do it through the New York Stock Exchange.
Well, they could, but, I mean, there was, what they do is they give service. They would, they pay the fixed rate, maybe, if the trade was on the New York Stock Exchange, but then they recapture it by getting services from the broker. So there was, he'd pay the full amount, the commission, but then you turn around, one device was the broker would provide research or Wall Street Journal subscriptions or office desks and you know, that sort of thing for the institutions. I mean, we knew at the commission the fixed, I mean, we made a policy statement that fixed rates were going to be eliminated. But we wanted to do it on our schedule and with monitoring each break as we went down to make sure that the industry could absorb it.
So I know during Bill Casey's time you got to 300,000.
Right, we were supposed to go to 100, but we postponed it to April 74.
I thought that you'd gone to 100 during your chairmanship.
No.
Okay.
No.
So you were still at 300 at that point?
I think so.
Okay. And was the industry saying, you know, this is hurting, but go ahead, or what was your sense?
No, they were saying the former. It was hurting and, you know, don't go. Don't go down any lower.
Uh-huh.
But again, you know, we didn't want to get, there was a collective position of the commission that we didn't want to become a public utility commission because we'd get these mammoth studies from the New York Stock Exchange justifying rates increases increases. And the industry was so diverse. That it was difficult to have any meaningful study and, you know, to justify this on economics. And again, as I said earlier, for the big boys, there was no fixed rate. First of all, because the trades at the break point was going down and trades by the institutions were going up because the market was becoming more institutionalized. So, the fixed rate really was a fixed rate for the small broker.
My understanding, though, was that a lot of the pressure was brought by the rise of institutional investing. A lot of the pressure to unfix rates.
Oh, that's true, yeah.
Okay, but if the big institutional investors were getting their cuts anyway, or you know, getting negotiated rates anyway, why would there be that pressure?
Well, they'd rather, I think, had the unfixed rate, so to speak, through cash and be able to, you know, negotiate rates down lower rather than all these convoluted indirect ways of getting the rate down.
So they figured out how to work the system.
Right.
They wouldn't have minded sort of paying for services rather than paying for offensive.
Yeah, they'd rather get it directly by lowering their commission costs.
Would the rise of institutional investors be the main cause for the agitation that was going on at this point for unfixing commission rates? Were there other things involved, like the back office crisis, for example?
Well, the back office situation was an argument to keep rates fixed, to keep the profit margin. Mm-hmm. And that was one of the small brokerage houses were screaming not to unfix rates because of that. That was one example. And, but then there was the institutions were threatening to join the exchanges. The New York Stock Exchange wouldn't permit, I'm not sure exactly why, or I guess it was in the rules, institutional membership. And, Philadelphia was actually courting the institutions, trying to build up its volume. And that's when we came up with this rule 19B2.
And the effect of 19B2 then was?
You couldn't join the exchange just to recapture rates,
okay.
Brokerage commissions.
Where was Harvey Pitt at this point?
Harvey was... Excuse me. I think Harvey was general counsel of the Division of Market Regulation.
Okay.
He was in the division before I took it over.
Mm-hmm.
And I know he was my general counsel in that division at that time.
It would seem that given that this is one of the big issues, and another one that we can talk about, which is the centralized market.
Right.
It seemed that market regulation was where things were at this point.
Well, it was interesting because, you know, Bill Casey, I think it was the summer of 72, I came in September 71 as the general counsel. And then in the summer of 72, Bill, and I had nothing to do with this, but Bill separated enforcement from regulation. And he was a great believer in regulating rather than enforcing, if you could do it that way. In other words, lay out the rules rather than let the law develop case by case. And so he called me into his office. He said, well, I've reorganized the enforcement and separated out the Division of Market Regulation. And I'm now looking for a director. And I said, well, I can't help you. I mean, I don't have any. I was really without not much knowledge in that area. And he said, well, I've picked a new director. I said, who? He said, you. I said, me? I said, I don't know anything about that, you know, the finite issues of all these issues that were going on. And he said, no, you'll be the best. And I said, well, what about general counsel? He said, well, you can keep that too if you want. And although that was never really formally recognized. So, called in the associate directors and said, you know, what are the big issues? And got some briefing up to date. But then I called Gus Levy, Goldman Sachs, who I knew well. My father had done a lot of business with Gus over the years. And I said, Gus, we've just formed this new division. And I said, I don't know what the big issues are, especially from the industry's point of view. Could you arrange a dinner and get together the leading Wall Street guys, and I'll come up and I'll just be a listening board. And he said, sure. So we had dinner in New York, and it was a who's who of New York Stock Exchange. Bill Donaldson, I don't think so. Gus Levy from Goldman Sachs, Cy, I can't think of his name, from Bear Stearns. Anyway, it was quite a collection of guys. And they hammered me for about 2 hours after dinner. And my defense was, I just took this division over. I don't know. I don't know anything about it. But so I don't really recollect the issues, but it was, you know, fixed rates and institutional membership, some esoteric rules, 10b-6. That's about all I can recall. But I mean, it was interesting. I came back and put together kind of a private memorandum for my own use on their points and discussed it with the staff. And but again, I can't recall. That's 35 years ago.
Sure.
I can't remember the specific issues.
Do you remember, I mean, did the staff come back and say, yes, but?
Well, yeah, we'd analyze each. Yeah, there was always a reason for doing it and a reason for not doing it. And, again, I don't recall the specifics of it.
What was the reception like at the commission, and really from the staff, when it came to this reorganization? It would seem that was a pretty significant step.
Well, again, I was not involved with the decision-making process to split trading and markets from separate enforcement to market regulation. And I'm sure that there was some disagreement by the staff because no one likes change. Although actually by, I don't know specifically by headcount, but I think that by having two divisions, there's more upward mobility than having one division. So I suspect that, depending where you ended up on which side of the ledger, it was good for the morale. It should have been good for the morale of the staff because there's more opportunities to advance upward.
Right. And Irv Pollock, for example, advanced upward to take over enforcement.
But I think he was head of trading markets before that. But Bill Casey was a great believer, again, in regulation.
Yeah.
Versus.
The interesting thing here is I had always understood that the split was done in order to strengthen enforcement. And it sounds like you're telling me something different.
I think just the opposite. I think it was done to strengthen market regulation and to give regulation a equal chair at the commission table.
Did it work out that way in practice?
I think so. Yeah. I mean, I don't recall ever knocking heads with enforcement. There was, you know, and I don't ever recall them knocking heads with us. The staff always tried to develop a uniform position before it went to the commission table. We didn't want to seem to be, you know, bickering among ourselves and trying to set a policy or carry out some type of action. So we always tried to iron out our differences at the staff level so we would go up with a uniform approach to the commission. And I can't recall, I'm sure there were some, but I can't recall one instance where we had a strong disagreement among ourselves. There may have been a strong disagreement among ourselves at the staff level, but that was ironed out before we got to the commission level.
Okay. Tell me a little bit about the commission. I would think as general counsel you would have been closely involved with some of the commissioners. Was that the case?
Bill Casey ran the SEC as a one-man shop. I mean, he was a very strong, dynamic, overbearing sometimes leader. And that's not to say that some of the commissioners didn't have good institutional input, but it was Bill Casey's show. So any controversial issue I would discuss with Bill rather than going to individual commissioners. I may have gone to individual commissioners, you know, but it was a rare situation.
How did the staff or see Casey?
Well, when I was there, I think they enjoyed him. Again, he was a strong guy, and he had a clear agenda. Again, I was not there when he developed his agenda because he was there, I think, about a year before, 6 months before I got there.
Yeah, tell me about that agenda. How would you define it?
Well, I think, again, more emphasis on regulation than on enforcement. There's always the situation where, you know, the enforcement division is being blamed for being, you know, overbearing, expanding the law, not laying out in advance, well, letting the law build case by case rather than by some regulatory fashion. Bill's theory was, we give you the rules, we lay out the regulation, if you violate it, then we're going to hammer you. But we're going to tell you in advance what we expect of you. And I kind of carried that on when we talk in terms of, you know, the insider trading situation where we were going to lay out a white paper which I don't think was ever done. I think it kind of died of its own. Because some of these cases or some of these issues are hard to define and don't lend themselves to regulation. In other words, how do you define fraud? If you define it 50 ways, somebody's going to come up with a 51 way. And then is that 151, that last one of the 50 gives you a free pass? So you can say, well, I followed every 50 rule. I just was clever enough to come up with 51. So, you know, you should regulate me first and tell me that 51 is bad. And let me, but I get a pass for coming up with, you know, this new way to commit fraud. So, the General Counsel's office and the Enforcement Division was kind of saying, you have to build the law case by case because we can never think of all the ways that brilliant minds, maniacal brilliant minds, can come up to work around the written rule, so to speak. And Bill was a strong believer in advisory committees from outside the commission to get industry involved.
Did he have those for things like unfixing commission?
There was a committee, I think, of... No, there was actually one on the central market system. And there was one on real estate, which I formed. There's one on compliance for broker-dealers, which I formed. There was one on enforcement on the Wells, Jack Wells, who was a lawyer in New York, where you'd get a Wells letter giving you the right to argue with the staff before it went to the commission level. And there was the industry on disclosure. There are a couple others I can't recall what they were, though. And then he also brought in his own kind of kitchen cabinet of young lawyers from New York, or mainly from the East, to kind of guide him through the issues. There was John Lifton, Lee Picard, and there were a couple others. I can't remember their names now. And I think that was an attempt to kind of work around the staff and try to get new ideas. And I never got at loggerheads with them, but I think the enforcement people did occasionally. Thought they were meddling.
You would think so, because their job is to do the thing that he wants to do.
Right, right.
Okay. Well, he seemed to have done an awful lot of things. He was only there less than 2 years.
Right, 20 months, I think.
Yeah. Was it a surprise when he decided to resign?
No. He and I had a conversation, actually. And this is after the second election of Nixon. And I said, Bill, what's your intention? Because, you know, usually anybody who would come in as a new chairman would want their own general counsel, would want to change some of the positions. And so my kind of fortune was tied to his plans. And he said, well, I think I'll move on. He wouldn't always be head of the CIA. Once a spook, always a spook. Because, he was in the
OSS.
OSS during the war. And I said, oh. And then I went down to my office and I started thinking, well, I always thought about that night, but I also thought about a little later. I said, well, what am I going to do? You know, I'm kind of in limbo here. So that's when I devised the plan to maybe move up to chairman. And I went back up to Bill's office a day or two later and I said, you know, what do you think about this idea? And he said, well, I really can't comment on it, but I think, you know, I wouldn't dissuade you from trying to become chairman. I didn't ask for his support because I thought that would be an unfair question. So that's kind of how the seed was planted for the, you know, my ascendancy to the chairman.
So why did you want to be chairman?
Well, I mean, it's, first of all, it's an honor, but I mean, it's a great, I'm trying to think of the right term, right word. Well, feather in your cap, so to speak, but I wanted to continue the agendas that we had, and, I had some ideas for additional issues. Well, director's responsibility was an issue for me because in private practice, and these issues are starting to come up, you know, more objective disclosures, rules.
Yeah, it sounds like you were about 30 or 40 years ahead of the time there with some of that.
Well, it was interesting because in 2004, I was on a panel discussion with the SEC, and I prepared a white paper, which I've got here, which is Carla has a copy of, and going over the issues that we were facing then, like the central market system, which I said in speeches in March of 73, that we wanted to have fully implemented in 2 years. Well, the national market system is still evolving. And here's been 36 or 35 years. So, I mean, we didn't quite meet our deadline in 2 years.
Yeah, I saw those headlines and I was struck, you know. It sounds so easy, sort of, at that point, saying, we'll do it in 2 years. And it's just been this constant struggle to figure out what to do
Yeah, there's so many technical aspects of which I've kind of lost track of. But, I think our 2 year window was, you know, really optimistic back in the early 70s or 73. I don't think we had the technical ability to do it from a computerization point of view.
And it was clear that's what it would take, right? Computerization.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Well,
the New York Stock Exchange would have fought it.
Right. I understand that there were hearings involved in this idea of the central market system. I mean, it was definitely a big issue. Do you recall congressional hearings?
I think the hearings took place after I left, because I don't recall any big hearings going on.
Was Casey pushing this centralized market idea?
Yeah.
And yeah. What was his rationale?
Well, that again, the markets were fragmented. There were upstairs markets, downstairs markets. This stock exchange, that stock exchange. There was a uniformity in the commission that a broker should have the responsibility of finding for its customer the best price, best execution, no matter where that was. Excuse me, and there should be competition among the various marketplaces. The New York Stock Exchange did not agree with that. So, I can recall having, that was one of the means, one of the issues that came up in New York with the industry, and I always said, I mean, God, the New York Stock Exchange is so powerful compared to the other exchanges that if they can't develop the best price for the security because of their liquidity and because of their strength, the vast resources they have, that something's wrong with our whole system. In other words, my theory was if there is competition among the exchanges, the marketplaces, the New York Stock Exchange has an opportunity to really dominate rather than to be threatened. This. They didn't see it that way.
But doesn't competition mean a fragmented market?
No, because, well, there's always a fragmented market. Always, I mean, because you've got the Pacific, you've got the Philadelphia, you had the, I think Salt Lake City was still in existence exchange. a couple of Cincinnati Exchange, like the Midwest Exchange in Chicago. But what was happening was that the customer, if he placed an order, our position was he was entitled to get the best price. And the best price may not be on the New York Stock Exchange. If it happened to be the best price, then the trade should be done there. But if it's not the best price, it should be done in Philadelphia or wherever. And in order to have a active market, you have to have, you know, deep pockets as a specialist, or in order to absorb losses, in order to make an orderly market. And the New York Stock Exchange had that. They had the strongest specialist industry. So, I mean, our theory was that a broker has an obligation to find the best price for the investor. Now, there's been a series of articles recently in the Wall Street Journal, you know, criticizing the national market system, because sometimes, especially for an institution, price is not the only criteria for what they're looking for. They're looking for, you know, speed sometimes. Sometimes secrecy. That was another aspect of it, of the central market system, that all trades had to be reported.
So the idea was that it would be great if the specialists on the New York Stock Exchange could direct trades elsewhere.
Or the broker would have to take it, the upstairs broker. And he'd put it through the specialist, and he'd check the specialist, say, well, you know, what's the price? But if he had to go to the Pacific Coast Stock Exchange or Midwest or wherever that stock was listed, he had to go to the best market for the customer, is the theory.
So I imagine you had lots of discussions about Rule 492. That was the one that kept people from going off the New York Stock.
What's 398? Is it, I think it's 396 or,
okay.
Again, I'm a little, my memory's not too strong on those rules. Yeah, because they had a rule that said you had to, you know, you couldn't take it off the exchange unless you were a member of their exchange. I think if you were a member of both exchanges, then you could take it off and go to whatever exchange you wanted.
How far did that, you made some good headlines with the 2-year announcement, but how far did that actually move during your time, both working for Bill Casey and Eddie?
Well, The white paper which John Lifton, I think, was the author of, or the primary author, had just been released in mid-March '73, and I left in May of '73. So, other than, you know, giving impetus through a few speeches, I was then cut out of, or, you know, not involved in the subsequent implementation.
What was the white paper? Did it
laid out the mechanics. It was kind of a, it laid out the theory of the central market system and how it would be implemented.
Was the idea then that this needed to be explored further and shaped?
Well, it was interesting because when I gave the speech in New York, we had a lot of criticism from the exchange. New York Stock Exchange. And we kind of switched tactics a little bit after that. We said, again, in subsequent speeches, we said, well, you know, we were open to comments. You know, this is the goal. This is where we're headed. We want to do this in 2 years, but we're open to talk. So we were kind of, you know, olive branch in one hand and a hammer in the other, which is, you know, the way a lot of things work in life.
Now, I noticed that there was a document called the Future Structure Statement that was put out under Casey. Does that ring a bell at all, having to do with the centralizer?
Well, I wonder if that's the white paper.
Yeah, something tells me that there was something under Casey, and then the white paper came out under your... But at any rate, I guess I wanted to get...
Well, there were hearings, I think. that Bill had been conducting before I got there, I believe. And again, we're talking 35 years ago. And I think there was I think he had hearings on, and it may have been when I was there, because I remember, well, he always encouraged, you know, as I did, public, you know, interplay with the commission to get in the industry's point of view.
Well, your plan to become chairman worked. how did you find out about it?
You never know what the machinations are at the White House. I was told, well, when I decided to consider making a effort to become chairman, I spoke to Gus Levy in New York and a guy named Bunny Lasker, who again I'd known before I got to Washington, but got to know better because they were big New York, I think they were both former governors of the New York Stock Exchange. And I said, you know, would you be supportive at the White House level? And they both agreed they would. Now, you never know for sure
right. If
they're just blowing smoke, but I don't think they were. And so they kind of carried on the quest. And I never had a meeting with anybody at the White House. I had a conversation with somebody from the White House one time, cryptically over the phone in February, where I'd been told that I was going to be designated as the chairman. And then I got a call, and I can't remember who it was from, in early February, saying they'd been put on hold. And so I called up Gus Levy and Bunny Lasker, and I said, things been put on hold. And he said, well, we'll find out why. And they came back and said that they were looking at some other individuals who were in the race, whose names I didn't know. And then I think it was a staff member of the SEC, I can't remember his name, came up to me and said, you're going to be the new chairman. And I said, how do you know? And he said, well, I know. And, I mean, there was no meeting with the president. There was no meeting with any of his staff members. It just kind of evolved. But again, you never know what the machinations are. You hear all kinds of rumors. People are for you. People are against you. You think you're too young. But.
Yeah. This must have been a pretty highly placed staff member who got the word from the White House.
He was.
You don't remember who that was?
Ted Burrow.
How do you spell that?
I can't. Ted's like still around. Okay. He was, I think, in the accountant's office. Or maybe he was a special assistant to Bill Casey. I can't remember which.
Casey had to hang in there while they put this thing on hold for a little
while. Yeah, I don't know exactly when he did officially leave.
Well, when you got in
there. As chairman.
Yeah, as chairman. You know, you'd been pretty close anyway. You'd been general counsel. You'd seen a lot. But
mm-hmm.
Was there something that you missed and you came in as chairman and you said, oh, so this is the way it is? I mean, was there anything new?
No. No, I mean, we had a pretty full pipeline of projects. I mean, we, you know, we had the central market system, we had the fixed rates, we had institutional membership, we had disclosure issues, we had enforcement cases were proceeding, equity funding was a big case, the Vesco case, of course, was huge. National student marketing was huge from the point of view that we sued lawyers. Now, we'd sued lawyers before, but not from prominent law firms. And this was, I think, when I was still general counsel. And we took a lot of flack for that. Because White & Case was one of the firms. And the other firm was from Chicago. Schiff Hardin, I think it was, which was a good law firm. And took a lot of grief for that, a lot of criticism from the bar.
Were the grounds contested, this idea that lawyers...
Well, we took the position, and again, this is 35 years ago, that we took the position that the lawyers were not merely just papering the transaction, they were guiding the transaction, and that they were culpable in not stopping the transaction when they should have done it. But again, you know, we historically, you know, the commission had sued lawyers, but, you know, not from big prominent law firms. And I don't know if we named the law firm or just named the lawyer in charge of the situation. But then we also named Pete Marek. Yeah. And then we had a criminal reference on them. And they were convicted.
And so was that National Student Marketing?
Yeah. The developer of Avanol here in Bethesda was one of the Pete Marek accountants who went to jail. His name escapes me right now, but...
Well, my understanding was that this whole rationale, this accountants and lawyers thing, was fairly new.
Well, we didn't think it was new. I mean, we had precedent. We had cases collected, especially on the accounting side. But again, it was new with big law firms. And there was a lot of hair pulling at the staff level, whether they should be named or not named or whatever. And... I mean, we took. Well, I think almost I was leading the charge on that. I mean, the idea was planted in memos, that, you know, staff memos. But you know, I concurred in whatever decision was made, and I was kind of the point person on that.
This is as general counsel.
Yeah.
Why? Why did you want to do that?
Well, I thought they were culpable. Yeah.
How about equity funding? You said that
equity funding came just at the end of my tenure. It came in, I think, in April or May of 73. And, because I remember I was down in Dallas to give a speech. And I got a call from, I think, Stan Sporkin or Herb Pollack. And then talk to the judge, federal judge, had a conversation. And, but again, my memory is foggy. It was a big case because it was, you know, involved a lot of false insurance policies that had never been sold or never been, they'd been booked but didn't exist. And, it'd been a great institutional stock favorite by the institutions and, it's kind of like the Enron and the WorldCom issue that, you know, how can this happen? I mean, how can you get away with such a mammoth, massive fraud?
Everybody's looking the other way.
Yeah, yeah.
So was it the same deal as National Student Marketing, where you had accounting firm?
No, well, it took, I don't recall the aftermath because it took place after I left.
Talking to people from enforcement as they were moving these things through.
Oh, yeah.
And you mentioned Stan Sporkin.
Mm-hmm.
He was in enforcement at this point?
Yeah, he was the assistant director, I think, under Irv.
Did you have a sense at that time what a kind of dynamic individual you had?
Stan is a good friend. And I have a great deal of admiration for him. He was always, I think by the trade, always depicted him as kind of a wild man. But he is the most controlled individual that there is. I mean, he's not wild at all. And of course, his subsequent career, where he's now in private practice, and you know, he's gone through a judgeship, and he was general counsel of the CIA for. And I like Stan a lot. We used to play tennis together quite a bit. So.
Yeah, I think just the fact that he was so influential from his position later in the 70s.
Yeah.
It's kind of unprecedented. It probably remains
that. Yeah. He was probably a good chairman, I think. Or a good commissioner. Although, actually, in his position, I'd rather be head of enforcement than be a commissioner.
Yeah.
For the same reason, I'd rather be general counsel than just a commissioner.
Yeah, under other issues, I mean, the big ones are clearly this centralized market and the commission rates. And it sounds like the centralized market didn't go too far while you were in there.
Well, we had just given it birth in April of 73.
Okay.
And
as far as commission rates are concerned, you're doing this
incrementally. Prudent gradualism, which, again, I came up with the term. I don't know. I mean, it just dawned on me. And Bill Casey latched onto it, and because it had kind of a catchy, you know, ring to it.
And it's really hard to argue with prudence. You
know? Yeah, and gradualism.
it looked to me as if, you know, you were getting challenged on that toward the end of your time in the commission, where you have Congress is holding hearings and saying, you know, the SEC needs to stop this. Postponing things. At the same time, you've got the Antitrust Division of the Justice Department.
On our backs.
Yeah. What was that? Do you remember that situation?
Well, I remember having a meeting with Kleindienst, who was then Attorney General, which was set up by somebody at the White House, because I think I called somebody at the White House and said, or I talked, I said, maybe it was Bill Casey, that was still around. I don't know if I was chairman or, you know, what time frame this took place. But I went over to meet with Kleindienst in his office at the Justice Department, and the Attorney General's office is a huge mammoth office. I mean, it's like something to Versailles. And I walked in, shook hands, introduced myself to him, and I said, you know, we've got a problem here. And there was an assistant AG, a guy named Baker, who was on her back the most. And I said, you know, we're proceeding here. This is our jurisdiction. We have the expertise. You have a difficult situation in the brokerage community. You have a stock market that's down. Just coming off the back office issues. You know, let us handle this on the rate commission. And he paid lip service to us. And, you know, kind of nodded his head. And then he said, have you seen my cane? I said, no, and he had this thing that looked like a stick. And I said, what is this? He says, a whale's penis. I don't know if you want to record this. And so, you'll erase that?
Let's put that in for posterity.
Okay.
And we can just take it out. So you went to visit Kleindienst's office.
Right.
To talk about this, tell him to let up a little bit.
Right. Keep out of our area. And he just, as I said, he paid lip service and did not treat it serious at all. And then he showed me his cane. And he said, you know what this is? And I said, no. He said, well, it's a whale's penis. It was given to me by the Alaskan Indians or something. And then that was the end of the conversation. And when I got back to the office, somebody said, well, how'd it go? And I said, well, he showed me his whale penis. So I guess that's how it went.
Not much of an accomplishment.
No.
What was driving Justice to do this?
Well, I think it was it was their antitrust division, and Baker was, I think, ahead of that. And they were just on a tear to eliminate fixed rates. And they also, I think, also got involved in institutional membership. They thought that, you know, an institution should become a, can become a member of an exchange, if the exchange would have them. And, you know, they were just pushing for total openness in that area. And, you know, we wanted to keep jurisdiction. And we probably thought that, I mean, I think realistically we thought exclusive jurisdiction probably was not going to work. But we had, I think we were successful, I think, in establishing that we had primary jurisdiction.
What was your position on institutional membership?
Well, our position was really 19b-2, the rule, that you could become a member of an exchange as an institution, but you had to be doing, you couldn't join just for the sake of recapturing commissions.
Okay. There's something else I have in my notes, earnings projections.
FD, fair disclosure. Well, again, it's almost as if in their release that was issued, what, 2 years ago? It's been 2 years or 3 years since that rule was put in. Then I look back at a speech I gave on equality and information to the public. And it's almost as if they copied word for word in the release, final release on, on Rule FD with that speech. And that was that... you know, that research should, well, or inside information, material facts should be available to the public the same time it's available to anyone else.
Where did the impetus to that announcement?
Boy.
Was it some of the insider trading cases that you were
in? Well, there was that. We were developing a white paper that was being developed on insider trading, and what it consisted of and what our position was. Again, I don't think, as I said earlier, I don't think that it was ever issued. I think it got bogged down, and I think it was also on earnings projections. We had hearings on that, you know, if you're going to give a projection, it should be given to everybody at the same time. It didn't require you to make a projection, but if you'd made one, you couldn't just disclose it to an institution or without making it generally available to the public.
Now, were these SEC hearings?
Yes.
Okay. So would you have folks from the industry come
in? Yeah. And lawyers. you know, I think we were trying to develop also a safe harbor for if you made a projection. And then the question is, do you have to correct it? And
right. What was the reception from the industry?
Well, I think on the projection issue, I think it was all over the map. I think that the lawyers wanted a safe harbor, and I think the compromise was we said you don't have to make projections, but if you do make a projection, then the issue was, do you have to correct it or modify it? And I can't recall what our position was on that. I think I know from a business point of view what our theory was or what our position was. And our position was that if you make an incorrect projection, that you should correct it just from a business point of view to let your stockholders know that, and of course, if you had a projection that was incorrect, you couldn't trade internally on the stock without making the public. So you were frozen as, you know, in dealing in the stock.
Now, this didn't make it into actual rules, did it?
I think it did. I think there was a rule issued on projections.
Okay.
I think I'd have to.
Can certainly look that up. Because again, it's the kind of issue that came up I came much later.
Oh yeah, FD. I mean, it's a reincarnation.
Right. Anything we haven't touched on, either when you were working for Bill Casey or when you were chairman, notable incidents or issues that you were dealing with?
No, I think we've covered everything.
Now, the decision for you to resign, this was something, you know, you were under no obligation to do so. It was purely your decision.
It was purely my decision because what happened was that, you know, it involved the Vesco case.
Right.
And this was a case that we, well, the history there was I was called up to Bill Casey's office. And he said, we had this case involving Robert Vesco in International Controls that's in the Enforcement Division, and it's been kicking around, doesn't seem to be coming to any fruition. I'd like to have you get in charge and bring it to either action or no action. And now, with the benefit of hindsight, I can think of a lot of questions I should have asked. I mean, one being, why me, and how does this reflect upon Stan Sporkin or the Enforcement Division? I mean, you know, you're actually taking a case away, so to speak. And so, which I didn't ask. At the time it didn't even dawn on me, I don't think. Plus I was, you know, being a good soldier, and Bill Casey told you to do something, you did it.
Right.
I mean, you didn't argue. Unless you wanted to stay there at 500 North Capitol, you didn't argue.
So it would seem that enforcement was trying to make their case, but they weren't doing it.
Well, these mammoth cases take a lot of time. You know, I mean, they're all building blocks. And what happens is you take the statement of one defendant, leads you to another defendant, leads you to another defendant or to a witness or whatever. And there's no reason to be in a hurry. I mean, you're billing it block by block. And this was a mammoth fraud. And there were all kinds of offshore bank accounts, and it was very hard to trace everything. So we have our first meeting. I have my first meeting with Robert Vesco in my office. And I think the staff was there, I'm pretty sure. And after the meeting, I went up to Bill Casey's office. I said, Bill, I've just met Robert Vesco. He said, what do you think? And I said, the guy is a slime ball. I said, this guy is a crook. He is despicable, and this case is going to go all the way. And Bill said, fine. And so I had a couple more meetings with him, with Vesco, and, you know, we were getting nowhere. It was a dance. And Vesco called Stan Sporkin the best of the worst. He referred to Stan that way in the meetings.
The best of the worst.
But he was he just made your skin crawl. I mean, he was a bright guy, Vesco. But he, and probably if he'd done it the honest way, he probably could have done it. You know, I mean, just taking him maybe a year longer.
Was the deal that you were trying to get him to, you know, settle at something? Or?
Well, he was trying to bring OSI, what, Overseas Investment Services,
IOS,
onshore here in order to expand its marketing. It was a mutual fund company.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we said, yeah, if you give us all the disclosures, who owns the stock, who does this, who does that, because it was in a Panamanian corporation. I mean, there's all kinds of secrecy. And, you know, it was just a dance. And, but as part of the, what happened was, I had testified before the grand jury. And, involving conversations I had with Marie Stans. And, before I went on this trip, where I met Stans, I've been told by, well, also in my conversation with Bill Casey, that first conversation I had after meeting Vesco for the first time, I said, Bill, one of my staff members in the general counsel's office says that in 1968, Vesco had made a contribution to the Republican Party. And I said, this case is going all the way, and this guy is a guy you don't want to do business with. So I'm not in a position to do it, but you are, to tell anybody where you have to tell them, don't take any money from this guy, because it's going to be an embarrassment. Now, I don't know if you ever told anybody or not. He never confirmed or not confirmed to me that.
But he's talking about the administration.
Yeah, the Nixon White House.
Right.
I was talking about it. So before I go on this hunting trip, where I'm going to, and I knew, I met Stans a couple times before, I had known that, you know, this possible contribution had been given in 68. And also we had taken the statement of a couple of people that alluded to cash coming in and a suitcase and so forth. And so when I met Stans, who was the head of the committee to reelect the president, I said, Mr. Stans, we have this case going, and we think that some cash has come into the country, and we're trying to trace it. Now, did it go to the Republican Party? And he said, no, we didn't take any money from Robert Vesco. He lied to me. So I came back from the trip, and I told Stan Sporkin this. I had this conversation, and he said, maybe we should take Stan's statement to see where this money, if he did get it. And I said, Stanley, you do what you have to do. I mean, that's up to you. And but in my first grand jury testimony, they asked me if I'd had a conversation with Marie Stans. I said, yeah, what'd you talk about? He said, well, the weather, and which was true, but I'd left out this other conversation because we were still, you know, I think it was, although the case had been brought by that time. But I was starting to be criticized by the press, for me personally, taking focus off of the case. And this was the biggest case we'd brought. And so as the pressure built up, kept asking me, you know, did you not talk to Stans, da, 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 da. And I went before the second grand jury and said, yes, I had talked to Stans. And we had talked about the money, what he'd said to me. And I also had a couple of conversations with Stans after that. And but each time I did have a conversation, I always told Stan Sporkin. And but again, I was, you know, kind of locked into my first grand jury testimony where I had not been totally candid. Although if you correct it in the same grand jury, it's not perjurious. But again, all the pressure started, you know, Brad Cook, instead of Vesco.
And it moved pretty fast.
Yeah, it moved real fast. So I said, well, for the benefit of the agency, take the focus, you know, the focus is being misplaced here. So I should go and, you know, let the chips fall where they fall. Now, with the benefit of hindsight, what should I resign? I've asked myself that 1,000 times. And I think that if I had to do it over again with the same circumstances and facts, I would say no. I would gut it out. I would not have resigned.
How much was that ever a chance? I mean, did you...
Not to resign, or...
Yeah. At that time, were you pretty clear on the fact that you needed to do that?
Yeah. I mean, it was at the time.
It wasn't a toss of the dice, right?
No. I mean, it had been building for, you know, 2 or 3 weeks. Everywhere I went, I was, you know, the reporter wouldn't give us any, the agency any credit for the case. They'd always say, you know, what's your involvement here? And I just thought the focus was being misplaced. And the one thing I think that people who work at the SEC universally find is that it's probably the best agency in government. And, I mean, it's a place that rages with talent and dedication. And if anything, I felt that, you know, I owed it to the agency that to, you know, make a kind of a mea culpa, so to speak, and move on. And it hurt. I mean, you know, because there's been a lot of misinformation put out. I was reading and preparing for today's conversation. I was looking at the historical files, you know, the SEC, where Mayor Eisenberg said I was indicted. I was never indicted. And in fact, I have a letter was given to me by Leon Jaworski, who was the special Watergate prosecutor, saying, because Proxmire, I testified in secret before his committee, before him actually, and he referred my testimony to the special Watergate prosecutor. They came back with a letter saying, addressed to Proxmire, saying that as a matter of policy, law, and facts, Mr. Cook should not be indicted for anything. And, I mean,
you have a copy of that letter?
Probably do somewhere. But, the other thing is when the press had me down in Miami at the Republican convention meeting with Vesco's lawyer. I was never in Miami. I was under the Hatch Act. I couldn't go down. I mean, I couldn't be involved in politics anyway.
Right.
But, you know, wild stories.
Well, you know, since you did make the decision to step down, and your time as chairman was fairly short, and even as general counsel, we're talking about a couple, 2.5, 3 years.
It's from September 71 to May 18th, I think, or 17th of 73.
Okay. The funny thing is, although it's a short time, it seemed like a lot happened during that.
Well, again, I mean, Bill was a dynamic guy and had an agenda that he wanted to get done. And he pushed hard. And he was a prodigious worker. And a very bright guy. And a good leader.
Other than the obvious, the organizational reshuffling, do you feel like the commission itself changed during that time period?
No. Well, there were changes in personnel. But, I'm sure some of the commissioners, I think, who are all deceased now. I mean, Phil Loomis is dead, I think. John Evans is dead. Hugh Owens, I think, is dead. Sid Herlong, I believe, is dead. Actually, John Evans came on, and when Jim Needham left, I think, and Jim Evans came on under when I was chairman, because I swore him in. And now, I don't want to besmirch their independence or their abilities, because they were all good guys and good men and honest and hardworking and so forth. But under Bill Casey, it was a one-man show.
Yeah.
And I was more inclusive, but I also kind of took that page from Bill's book, and I was trying to set the same agenda. I mean, you know, we've got these things. Because what happens, tendency happens in any kind of government situation is that things just kind of percolate and percolate and percolate and take forever to get it to come up. And one of the benefits of the SEC is that you can always change it. I mean, if you make a mistake, if it's not quite right, you can always quickly change it. So that was Bill's philosophy that, you know, let's get this done. You know, it's not a perfect world. It won't be perfect, but at least it'll be better than it is now. And then we can tinker with it down the road because we're the agency that has the experience and the expertise. So
the idea was that you were willing to give things a try.
Yeah. Yeah. Because I think under Manny Cohn, who I think was more enforcement orientated, had been with the agency, I think, for years, and Bill, I mean, I wouldn't say Bill's agenda was a Republican agenda or a political agenda. It was just, let's get it done. I mean, these things have been going around, around, around. And let's, you know, let's move on them.
And a regulatory agenda, right?
Yeah, rather than enforcement.
Is there anything else that we haven't talked about?
Lots of things. The Nebraska football team.
Well, I don't know if we need to talk about that.
Okay.
I'd like to thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Ken.